Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A foster care system that left two teens dead from starvation. A controversial shift to privately managed care involving Medicaid dollars. Well, the Iowa Department of Human Services has been in the news a lot in the past year or so. This half hour, my guest is the new DHS Director, Jerry Foxhoven. Foxhoven took over for former Director Charles Palmer. That was in mid-June. He's a Des Moines lawyer. He's well known for his children and family rights advocacy. Former longtime head of the Neal and B. Smith Legal Clinic at Drake University. Also Drake's Joan and Lyle Middleton Center for Children's Rights. Jerry Foxhoven joins us for this half hour. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben. Nice to be here.
Look, it's been 4 months, so let's go back since you took this office 4 months. The DHS, one of the state's largest agencies, administering not only child protection, but programs and funding for people with disabilities. It administers the state's $4 billion Medicaid insurance program. And we know that since early last year, 2016, Medicaid in Iowa has been managed by three private companies. Let's look back over these 4 months and get your take on it. When you took over in June, what were your highest, most urgent priorities?
Well, there was a lot going on at one time. Number one, we had some tragedies in the child welfare system. I needed to get a handle on that right away to make sure that we were doing what was necessary to address any gaps that we had at that point. Also, we were ready to begin a new year with managed care. We didn't have contracts yet for the next year signed, and so beginning negotiations with the managed care organizations was a top priority and has been taking a lot of my time. We're still in those negotiations. I was last involved with it just about an hour ago.
So let's talk about those two points and a couple of other ones. We had the deaths of Natalie Finn and Sabrina Ray. A huge outcry because of their deaths. They were in the foster care system. The girls both died of starvation. What safeguards have you put in place to make sure that won't happen again?
Well, first of all, let me say this, Ben, that we could never guarantee that no kid would be hurt or harmed or die in the system or out of the system. It's like the President of the United States has a dozen people surrounding him all the time, and yet if you talk to the Secret Service, they'd say we can't guarantee that the President won't be hurt. Anytime a tragedy happens, we really have to step back and say, what could we have done differently that may have helped, and what could we do differently that will help in the future? So we've done a number of things. We've made a number of changes already, and we've got other things in the work, and I'm really happy to share those with you. The first thing that we did right away is that we changed some of our training for our child abuse investigators to basically prioritize complaints from mandatory reporters that have special training. So like a report that comes from a doctor or a nurse or a teacher, if they have expertise in an area, those should be given greater weight. Secondly, in the past, when we would get a complaint of child abuse on somebody, and let me tell you, Ben, we get 58,000 of those a year in Iowa, so we get a lot of them. When we get a complaint, a child abuse complaint, if we already had one pending at the time, we would attach it as an addendum to that report, have the same person investigate that child abuse complaint who's investigating the current one. And that's appropriate to use the same person to investigate. What wasn't appropriate was that by attaching it as an addendum, then a couple of years later when a worker gets a complaint and they look back, they'd only see one complaint rather than maybe four or five. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we've done immediately was when we get a child abuse complaint, if there's one pending, we treat it as a new one so that 2 years from now, if we get some concerns about somebody, we can look back and we can see we actually had four complaints 2 years ago, not one complaint. So that's a big change. The third thing is that one of the commonalities on both of those cases was that these were kids that were adopted from foster care and they received a subsidy for the adoption, the parents did. And we have always treated, when somebody adopts kids, they're just like any other parent. And so we don't do anything to monitor or do anything once the adoption has occurred unless we get a child abuse report or something that causes us to take a look. And so we have started the process to redo our contracts with the adoption subsidies and to work through the federal government and the state to create a procedure whereby we will require people who receive a subsidy to take their adopted child to the doctor at least once a year to provide at least one set of eyes, an extra set of eyes, and a professionals and somebody who's a mandatory reporter. Those have already been done. Now, the next thing that I wanted to do right away was to start taking a look at how did these people become adoptive parents to begin with.
Right.
And so, obviously, I don't think if the allegations are true and these people did what is alleged that they've done, then they didn't just turn into those kind of people overnight. And so how did they become foster and adoptive parents to begin with? So we're going all the way upstream to take a look at our recruitment and retention process, and are we doing a good job? Do we need to make changes? And clearly we do. And so that's what we're looking at, to change the quality of the people that are fostering and adopting.
Right, better vetting of prospective foster parents. Are you then also going to reviewing existing foster parents to make sure they live up to these new standards?
Yes, certainly we're going to hold all of our foster parents accountable. Now, again, adoptive parents, we would not. Once they have right. adopted, they become parents just like birth parents, and unless there's some reason for us to get involved, with the exception of the doctor's appointment, we wouldn't go back and take a look at them.
Okay. Let's talk about the other point you mentioned, too, the big thing on your plate, the transition to privately run Medicaid that occurred in 2016. It's led to complaints. Let me just remind our listeners who perhaps have just joined us. Jerry Foxhoven is my guest, the new director of the Iowa Department of Human Services, in that position now for 4 months since June. The transition to privately run Medicaid occurred in 2016. It led to complaints, many of which voiced by our listeners when we've had that topic, Jerry Foxhoven, on this program. We've opened up the phones. Boy, did we get complaints. Complaints about reduced spending on care for the poor or disabled. Other complaints as well, just the hassle of dealing with these three companies that privately manage Medicaid dollars now in our state. I understand that the three firms continue to lose tens of millions of dollars. Describe for us the problems you see that need to be addressed that you are managing with the privately managed Medicaid.
Okay, well, first of all, you know, when we say the companies are still losing millions of dollars, that's kind of as expected. I think when all three of them came in and entered this arena here, they all projected that they would lose substantial funds at the beginning. That's the way this business works. You know, they start out because they have a lot of upfront administrative costs. They have the whole idea of managed care requires that we change kind of the health of the population, and that's a kind of a long-term savings. So all of the companies felt that we're going to lose money up front the first year, we're going to lose a little less the next year, and that we're going to want to see a path to success over the course of 3 or 4 years. I think they're all seeing that in different companies on different levels. And so the first thing I'd say is that this isn't really a surprise, and I think we're moving in the right direction on it. Secondly, there have been a lot of complaints, and of course there will be. This is a huge change. 24.7% of Iowans are on Medicaid. So that's a quarter, one out of every four Iowans. So if you just changed insurance policies for a quarter of Iowa's population, there'd be a lot of people, providers upset,
insured
upset. So
right.
of course, anytime you get a change that big.
But with respect, when this was discussed, the transition was not advertised as a bumpy ride lasting several years. It was advertised as a more efficient way to manage Medicaid dollars. And it would save money.
And I think, first of all, I think it has saved money. And secondly, in the end, it is more efficient. Now, I would say this, that anytime you do a big transition like that, it's going to feel bumpy as you get there. The other thing that I will say is that where we were before managed care, I try to tell people all the time, I never realized it ran that well because I heard a lot of complaints back then. And now nobody remembers any of the bumps that we had back then. They only remember the times that it worked well. And lastly, I'd say this, Ben, is that, you know, again, part of the purpose of managed care, of moving to the managed care system, was not just to save money. That was a piece. A piece was to save money initially. But part of it was to make the program sustainable over the long term. If we think about the fact that there's one of the insurance companies that's on the exchange, the governor's trying to get the stopgap provision right now to deal with this, but the one company that's on the exchange talked about raising the rates 57%. That's unsustainable if we're talking about a quarter of the Iowa population. In some way, we have to start managing care in such a way that we control the costs so that they don't get out of hand. Because the end result is, if we let the costs get out of hand, then we can't insure that 24.7% of Iowans. That means either there are things that we don't provide coverage for, or it means there are people that we don't provide coverage for. And so basically, we've made a commitment in Iowa of, you know, we want to try to make this system sustainable so that people continue to have that kind of coverage.
So you mentioned that actually the contracts, the state still doesn't have the contracts for the fiscal year that started in July 1st, and then within the last few hours, you've been working on this. So where does that stand? Where are the negotiations? What is holding it up?
Well, Ben, you know, I hate to say where does it stand in terms of when do I think we'll have this resolved. I think soon, but I keep saying that. When I first came in, I thought, holy moly, we're halfway through June. We need a contract that starts July 1st. We need to get on with it. That's kind of been the way I would traditionally look at things. And then I find out most states don't have their contract signed until well into the fiscal year. In fact, some states didn't have their contract signed for last year into April. Now, we're not going to go into April, and I think we're getting closer and closer and closer to get resolution here. So I think we'll have a contract soon. We will start negotiations probably 60 days after we get a contract soon signed, so that for the next year, so that, you know, my commitment to the governor is we're not going to be in this place next year. We will have a contract before the fiscal year starts, and I will do everything I can to make that happen. But what are the sticking points? There's a natural kind of incompatibility or bump between the state and the managed care organizations, in that the managed care organizations, of course, want to turn the corner and be profitable, and so they want to basically say, get out of our way and let us manage care. That's a natural position that they're going to take. The state, on the other hand, is providing insurance coverage, medical coverage to a quarter of its population, who are the most vulnerable people in the state, and we want to exercise as much oversight as possible to make sure that the people get the services that they need. So that creates in itself, you know, a dynamic where we're on opposite ends in some ways. So I only say that to say the issues are not just money. Obviously, money's part of it, arguing about the money. My job is to be a good steward of the taxpayers' dollars and to try to make sure that we get the best possible financial deal out of this. But also my job is to provide as much oversight as possible to ensure protection of the people that are covered. And naturally, the managed care organizations would say, all that oversight prevents us from becoming profitable. And so we're talking a contract that's 110, 120 pages long. So there's all kinds of provisions in there that provide oversight that we deal with the MCOs to say, is this necessary or not? Does it prevent you from managing care properly or not?
Mm-hmm. I understand that you've said it's possible that managed care might not be the best way to handle some sorts of cases, some more complex cases that the state was managing, used to manage under the Medicaid system. Are there any plans to look at certain cases and sort of shift those cases back under direct state oversight?
No, there's not. And let me just clarify what my position is on how we're using managed care right now for some of that population isn't working as well as it should. Because the traditional tenets of managed care, which is, you know, you get a 45-year-old man who smokes and is overweight. He's a candidate for a heart attack at some point, and you kind of work with him to get him a regular family doctor, get him a diet, get him some exercise, cessation of smoking, improve the health, saves money in the long run because he doesn't have a heart attack. Those things don't happen for someone. I mean, that you're not going to improve the health of someone who's a quadriplegic, who's on a ventilator. And so the traditional tenets of why managed care can be a success don't necessarily apply to that population. That doesn't mean that managed care can't work for them. It just means we have to deal with it differently, and that's part of what we're doing here as we negotiate contracts, is to work with the MCOs to say, how do we approach that population differently to make sure that we meet their needs better?
Mm-hmm. Jerry Foxhoven, new director of the Iowa Department of Human Services, if you've just joined us this half hour on River to River. Before we end this conversation, I wanted to make sure we address mental health services. Earlier this week on this program, we heard from the director of Oak Place, that's in Centerville, a community-based mental health services provider. I spoke with Jackie Sharp. She's director of Oak Place. It's a stabilization mental health care home in Centerville. It has received national recognition. It's a model for effective care, but they are going to have to close their doors at the end of this month due to lack of funding. Let me have play a little bit of what Jackie Sharp said about her situation, why her doors are closing, even though it seems to be a very effective community-based mental health care facility, and have you react to that.
Without funding, we're closed. And I have a fear for the other 10 crisis stabilization homes in the state that they will follow our lead and close due to lack of funding.
Mm-hmm.
After Governor Branstad closed the institutions, he also converted our insurance industry to managed care organizations. And the managed care organizations did not pick up this level of care. It was all left up to the regions to pay for this level of care. And while it's much cheaper than inpatient psychiatric care, it is expensive to do. And this is something that the regions, the counties, have not been expected to do in the past. It is effective. I think they need to see the usefulness of it. I think it creates a lot of safety for our communities, and it also takes the pressure off our court systems and our jails. So it saves money not only in the difference between inpatient care and what we cost, but it saves other systems as well. And I fear that the other 10 will wind up at the same fate that we are if something isn't changed in our system.
Jackie Sharp, earlier this week on the program, executive director for Oak Place, a crisis stabilization mental health care home in Centerville, due to close at the end of this month. How familiar are you with this? And it seems you've got a very effective model. It's in a converted ranch home. From what I could tell talking on that program earlier this week, everybody loves it. It's very effective, has served over 200 patients who've been reintegrated with the community. Does this have your attention at all, Jerry?
Yeah, it does. It does have my attention, and I know that there were some other options that were offered that would have kept that open, that they weren't willing to participate in. But let me just talk on a bigger scale about this. What we need to start looking at, and what I'm trying to drive for changes, is that we start looking at not just saying, is this a case, or is this a piece that should be funded by Medicaid, or is this a piece that should be funded by the county regions for mental health services, but that we start braiding the funding, that we start looking at all the potential funding sources. We're all in this together in terms of providing these needs. And so it doesn't make any sense for us to say only the MCOs should pay for this or only the regions should pay for this. What makes more sense to me is for me to work with the regions, and that's going to be part of my responsibility, to help them develop a plan in their region, to look at their region of what makes sense and what are the gaps in services that you need so that you get the full array of services. So you may have an inpatient facility, and you may have some much lower-level facilities, but as she pointed out, this is that in between where there's a place for people to go that gets them out of the inpatient, which is much more expensive, but when they're not quite ready to go home or in other less costly places. It makes sense to me to work with the regions, to have the regions assess their region, what services are available and what gaps are available, and then help create that environment to get those things started, and then we negotiate to put that as part of the MCOs. Once that gets created and the regions have kind of helped get that gap met, then it makes sense for the MCO to say, well, I can save money instead of inpatient. I can send it to a place like this, and that's I can send them there, and it makes a lot more sense economically. So if we just try to push it off on the MCOs, they're not in the business of going out starting business or assessing that particular region or county. The counties are in a better position to look at what services do they have, what gaps are there, what services do we need, start facilitating that happening, and then we drive the MCOs, the managed care organizations, to invest their dollars there because it's cheaper than inpatient.
Okay, and finally, how did you find morale in the department 4 months ago when you entered this position, and what are you doing to improve it? I understand it was in poor shape.
It was in poor shape, and part of it you can understand with the press. I'm not blaming the press, but if you read just the press accounts, you know, terrible tragedies had been happening, a lot of disputes over managed care, a lot of complaints. So people never really felt appreciated. Their caseloads have gone up and so forth. We've done a lot to raise that morale. I'm trying to find out what their needs are, what we can get off their plate, the social workers. I went, for instance, to Polk County, talked to our social workers, and they didn't have cell phones. They're trying to investigate child abuse complaints and work with parents and kids, and they don't even have a cell phone, which I think is essential to their work. I met with the Polk County Board of Supervisors and the county managers, and they've agreed to provide those cell phones, so hats off to them and kudos to them for agreeing to do that. I think those kind of little things will really help morale a lot, and I'm seeing it come up. We're seeing morale raise really substantially just by letting them know, we're going to listen to you, help you tell us what we need to get off your plate so you can do a good job. We're seeing morale go up really a lot right now.
Okay, thank you very much for your time. Jerry Foxhoven, director of the Iowa Department of Human Services, has been in that position since June, a few months, leading the state's, I guess we'd say, embattled Department of Human Services. Jerry Foxhoven, I look forward to checking in with you again in the future.
Me too. Thanks, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, I talk with Dan Manat. He's director of the new documentary film, The Fort, 177 Years of Crime and Punishment at the Iowa State Penitentiary. In the film, we'll hear about Iowa's longest-serving inmate, also how the death penalty was abolished here in Iowa in the 1960s, along with other fascinating history. That's after this short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.